This episode of HBR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HBR15. That's HBR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hello, Hacker Public Radio. This is Semiotic Robotic, and today I'm happy to bring you a very special open source news break from opensource.com. Today's episode is an interview show. I recently sat down with Michael Thiemann, Vice President of Open Source Affairs at Red Hat, to discuss his history as an open source entrepreneur. Here's a bit of background on Thiemann for those of you who might need it. In 1989, Thiemann co-founded Cygnus Solutions, the world's first company to offer support for open source software. 10 years after Cygnus Incorporated, it merged with Red Hat, so in 1999, Thiemann became Red Hat's chief technical officer. He also served as president of the Open Source Initiative, stepping down in 2012. Today, he continues his work as an open source evangelist through his writing and speaking. In fact, you'll find more of his work at opensource.com. Thiemann and I discussed the early days of the open source movement. I actually begin the interview by asking him to take us back to 1987. And the interview is full of anecdotes about its genesis. He explains to me how his company took $6,000 of startup capital and the odd idea that one might make money from so-called free software and turned it into millions. Finally, Thiemann shares his insight on the ways competition and innovation function in the open source software market. Chatting with him certainly was an honor, and I really do hope you enjoy listening to our conversation. I'll see you next episode, and as always, I wish you peace, love, and open source. All right. I am here with Michael Thiemann. Michael, thanks for being with me today.
Happy to be with you, Brian.
I'm wondering if we could start in, go all the way back, go back to 1987. And I'm wondering if you can describe for me the moment, or maybe it was a series of moments, that led you to the realization that building an open source business might not only be viable, but lucrative as well.
Well, in 1987, it was really more just beginning to realize the potential of open source. Mm-hmm. Richard Stallman had released the GNU C compiler in June of 1987, and I was familiar with GNU Emacs, which, if you've ever used Emacs, is a mind-blowing experience in and of itself. And I had also become acquainted with the GNU debugger as well. But the release of the compiler for me was a very watershed event because, first of all, I was really interested in compilers. I really wanted to work in the compiler field, and I saw absolutely no pathway to getting a job in that field because all the people who were employed there were far more senior than I was. They were tiny little companies that charged millions of dollars, and I saw no way to convince anybody that I could be on a team of two or three people justifying these multi-million dollar price tags. Mm-hmm. Along comes the GNU C compiler, and suddenly I get a chance to actually see a recipe for a compiler. And the recipe is not exactly simple. When I untarred the files, it was over 110,000 lines of code, and my very first inclination was to print it all out so that I could study it. And I had more than a few people visiting my cube during the day saying, "Are you sure you really want to be printing all this out?" And I said, "Yes." And I don't remember how many reams of paper it was, but it was a lot. Yeah. And I brought it home, and I just started poring over it. I had just bought a dining room table with two leaves, and I put both leaves in the table. And I started out by just putting each of the sheets of paper belonging to individual files in a pile. And then as I began reading it, I began sort of making links about, you know, this refers to that, and mm-hmm. here's this idea,
right.
et cetera. And over the course of a long weekend, I put into my mind what those 110,000 lines of code did.
Yeah.
And I started to write a machine description file and some other configuration files to do the very first port of the compiler external to the first two that Richard Stallman had created. And much to my amazement, a process which normally took 2 to 3 years and cost $2 to $3 million, namely the porting of a compiler, in 2 weeks, I had completed a compiler port which generated code 10% faster than the vendor's compiler. And that in and of itself sounds pretty special, and I was very proud of that. But the other little detail that really fired my imagination was that the port that I did this, the port that I accomplished, which was to a processor called the National Semiconductor 32032, had famously been sold as a 1 MIPS chip, but it did not deliver 1 MIPS. It delivered about 0.8 MIPS. And that was sort of seen as a failure in the marketplace. It left the window open for another vendor to come out with a higher performance chip and basically make National's effort worth nothing. So you do a little bit of math, and 10% better than 0.8 does not quite get you to that 1 MIPS number.
Right.
But after publishing what I had done after 2 weeks, I then spent another 2 weeks optimizing this port that I had done, and I got it up to a full MIPS on the chip. And so what that told me was that it was possible for an independent person to accomplish by themselves something that an entire company, an entire marketing team, an entire engineering and development team could not do, which was to hit a target.
Right,
and
exactly.
So I published those results, and actually one of the first invitations that I received to talk about this compiler came from Israel, came from the development team of National Semiconductor that was in, I believe, Herzliya. So I had no immediate plans to travel there, but a year later, when I took a job with the French government hacking open source software outside of Paris, that put me close enough that I was able to continue on and give a lecture at the Technion there in near Tel Aviv. So that was sort of the very beginning, and what excited me at that time, back in the 80s, there was a lot of microprocessor development. There were lots of different ideas. The Intel x86 had by no means won the war. The Macintosh was still a relatively new sensation, and the Motorola 68020, 030, 040 were just beginning their leapfrogs. Motorola and a lot of other chip companies were heavily investing in a new technology called RISC, Reduced Instruction Set Computing, and the microprocessor arena was about to explode with all kinds of new designs needing all kinds of new compilers. And later, after accomplishing this port to the National 32032, I then undertook the port to the Motorola 88000, and again, I beat the Motorola team by 10% on my first time at bat. That got a little bit of attention there, and then I started doing other compiler ports, and one day, a manual for the Spark processor from Sun showed up on my desk entirely anonymously, and I sort of, my first question was, who the heck sent this to me?
Yeah.
And my second question is, do I have enough time? I got it on a Friday, and I thought to myself, wouldn't it be cool if I could actually get the port done before I identify who actually sent it to me?
Right.
And in fact, that is what happened. I did a port over a weekend, and as I was coming into the final stretch, I remembered that Wayne Rosing from Sun Microsystems, he would later become the first CTO at Google, mm-hmm. but Wayne Rosing had visited our facility in Austin, Texas, had seen me doing some making some outrageous claims about the compiler. And I think on a lark, he just sent me the instruction manual, and I popped out of port. So wow. those were the early days, and that was just an example where, you know, if you imagine the part of the movie where, you know, that you throw everything at the right. you know at the protagonist, and somehow they send it back, yeah. you know, with an extra 10% speed on the ball.
Right.
That's where I was in 1987. Mm-hmm.
So when you said you published the code, today people would do that by pushing code to a online repository.
That's right.
How did you publish your code?
I published both the files, the complete files themselves, as mm-hmm. well as diff files to an FTP site
okay.
in Massachusetts. And okay. so we used FTP, and back in those days, one was very, very lucky. You know, my modem, I believe, was a 19.2 kbaud modem.
Nice,
and that was special.
Yeah,
and that was high end.
Smoking, yeah,
yeah. Back in the day, mm-hmm. of course, real companies had T1 lines, which we all know is a 1 megabit connection, but they usually only had one. Mm-hmm. And I actually got a visit when I was at India. The institute, the translation is the National Institute for Research and Computer Science, but in French it's Institut National pour Recherche en Informatique et Automatique, and I got a visit from the general administration people who were curious how it was that I was using more bandwidth than the rest of the whole lab combined, and I explained what I was doing, and they were very happy that I was only there for the summer. It was a summer job. I would be going soon, and that problem would go away.
It would solve itself. Yeah. So you once described another insight that you had at this time. You were thinking about the notion of the commons, mm-hmm. and you were thinking about the notion of law. And you wrote once about the way that code and law might be related to each other in this regard, with regard to a commons. And you said that while law is a common resource, lawyers are nevertheless fairly well paid for the work they do with the law. And so you made a case that software could work the same way. You applied this thinking to the business of supporting free software. And I'm wondering if you could elaborate on that insight for us a little bit.
Yeah, I can tell you that when I was promoting this idea that this superior technology could absolutely move the industry forward, I got a tremendous amount of pushback from people who basically said, look, in our capitalist environment, you cannot be successful if you cannot exclude competitors from the marketplace. Mm-hmm. You cannot be successful if you cannot force customers into a trap, basically. Mm-hmm. And I really did not believe that, because I saw so much potential gain for the industry to be able to move forward without impediments. That was, to my mind, any business whose success depended on slowing things down mm-hmm. was just a bad idea. And but it was very much counter the prevailing wisdom. And so I began looking to a whole bunch of different industries to try to figure out, are there analogies which, if one were to understand them in a slightly different way, they could justify that the software industry was also ripe for this transformation. Mm-hmm. And one of the first ones I did seize on was this analogy with lawyers, mm-hmm. that the law is not privileged information to which one needs a license. Mm-hmm. Every precedent becomes public domain. Mm-hmm. Yet the expertise that the lawyers have in knowing these precedents, in arguing these precedents, mm-hmm. in having composed briefs that inform these precedents, that when you look at the difference between the rates that a run-of-the-mill lawyer can charge versus, you know, a top lobbyist in Washington, D.C.,
right.
there's
right.
orders, there's many, many orders of magnitude there. And I saw an opportunity that basically said, hey, if we are more expert in being able to adapt this software faster, apply it to a wider range of problems, et cetera, if we can help people move to the next field faster, then we should be able to write a ticket based on the value that's opened by that. So that was one analogy, but there were some other analogies. Actually, one of my favorite analogies, once I got the lawyer thing working, I then started thinking about banks. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite analogies was, in the conventional world, a bank pays interest based on the amount of money that's deposited. Now, this analogy may make absolutely no sense in 2014, where banks basically no longer pay interest. But
is true.
Back in the day in the 1980s, you know, if you had a passbook savings account, you might expect to be paid 4 or 5% interest mm-hmm. on your savings.
Right.
And if you were willing to commit it for longer, you could get even a better rate mm-hmm. with a certificate of deposit, which again today basically pays no interest.
Right.
But imagine a bank where no matter how much you deposit, the bank pays interest on the sum total of all the mm-hmm. assets to which you make the deposit to. Mm-hmm. So if a whole bunch of my friends all put money into a communal bank account, mm-hmm. and then we all get paid mm-hmm. the total interest on that sum total,
right.
How attractive is that, number one? How attractive is it, number two, to go to a person who does not yet bank at that bank and
right.
tell them, you know what, all you need is $10 mm-hmm. to open an account, and you know, you can share in the interest on $250 or $1,000.
Right.
How cool would that be? And I began to sort of see that was the force multiplier of this free software ecosystem mm-hmm. and what later became known as the open source model, that by making small contributions to this code, I became a member of a community which aggregated all their enhancements as well. And so I put in a little mm-hmm. and I got back a lot. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to me to be an outrageously great trade. And it seemed to everybody else that they were making a good trade too. Mm-hmm. You know, they appreciated that Michael Tiemann was handing them free compiler patches
yep.
all the time.
So you found Cygnus then in 1987 based on these ideas?
No, in 1987, that was when I began the search for how to start Cygnus.
I see.
In
okay.
1987, after really convincing myself that this was the next big thing, mm-hmm. I then sought to find an entrepreneur who could found the business for
right.
me,
uh-huh, sure.
and I could be their first employee.
Uh-huh,
I wouldn't
uh-huh.
charge too much, but I would be a great worker, and I'd be very dedicated, and I had this track record that I could now really trade upon.
Right.
It was pretty exciting to see this reputation grow. It was very exciting when, at one point, Richard Stallman came out to Stanford University and, you know, we were talking about the hierarchy of programmers, and I was paying a compliment to somebody, you know, as being a potential wizard, and Stallman called me a wizard, and I just about fell out of my chair. But I could not find anybody who was willing to start a business around free software, because nobody could see how to exclude competitors. Mm-hmm. Nobody could see how to lock in customers. And so for 2 years, I struggled to find somebody who was willing to think outside those boxes, and I was simply unable to do so. Mm-hmm. And then as I was relating these problems to a friend of mine who I happened upon in the Stanford coffee shop in the student union, as I began explaining to him how difficult it was to find people who all agreed that this software was better than anything else out there, mm-hmm. but similarly were of the opinion that it would never work because
right.
nobody would pay money for free software. As I was explaining that, I had this amazing epiphany, which is that if everybody thought the software was better, it probably was, and if nobody thought the business would work, I would have no competition.
Yeah.
And it was that insight that made me believe, hey, if I can start a company with no competition, how could I fail?
So you've got skepticism on coming at you in three different directions. One from potential customers, one from potential business partners, and one from investors, right? Mm-hmm. So how can you recall at the time what some of those primary sticking points were from those folks? I mean, you say that they're saying it's not going to work. You can't exclude competitors, but is there any other points of skepticism these folks were really stuck on?
I think the real skepticism really was that because it had never been done before, nobody mm-hmm. believed it could be done. Mm-hmm. And so as soon as I had this insight, and at the time, I had enough money in my bank account to make the mortgage mm-hmm. and chip in to start a company, which I believed could go cash flow positive in time before my second rent payment.
Right. Okay.
So the great thing about starting a software company back then was that it cost almost nothing. We bought a computer, we bought a telephone, and then we started it in apartments. In fact, when I saw the movie The Social Network, mm-hmm. which is the story of Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook, mm-hmm. I had all these wicked flashbacks because apparently he started Facebook basically in exactly the neighborhood that we started Cygnus
wow.
in
wow.
back
yeah.
in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. And so I was intimately familiar with all those houses yeah. in Palo Alto. and although we didn't do any of the crazy stuff that they probably made up in the movie, it very much was something that we grew very organically out of the apartments. The original business plan called for the three founders to put in $5,000 a piece, except I didn't have $5,000. I only had $2,000. And so we started with an initial seed capital from three founders, mm-hmm. $2,000 a piece
yeah.
for a total of $6,000.
Okay.
And in November of 1999, we negotiated with Red Hat a sale of the company for $687 million that closed in January of 2000.
Well, I want to get to that in a moment, but talking about skepticism, it strikes me that, I think you've written about this before, but I also hear this still ongoing today, is this notion of fragmentation, right? There's this assumption that you can't make a business on free software, you can't make a business on open source software because fragmentation is going to be a persistent issue. Your platform is going to be so fragmented, everybody's going to do their own thing with the source code, you're never going to be able to support it, and you're never going to be able to exert the kind of control you need to make a profit on the product. How did you overcome that? And I think it persists today, so how do you respond to that today?
Well, with the benefit of hindsight, mm-hmm. what I have seen in many, many cases, both in the free and open source world, but also in the larger business community, is that really the key to success of an entrepreneurial business is having a vision you can execute, and having a vision that that people really want to buy into, because ultimately it benefits them comprehensively. It benefits not only their bottom line, it solves not only their problem of the day, but it moves them forward in their life in some meaningful way. And that could be up the career ladder, it could be saving the planet, it could be doing a whole bunch of other great things. But what I have sort of generalized from my experience is that a thing we did right at Cygnus was, by golly, we built a kick-ass software company. There was a point in time where the VP of engineering came to me and said, you know, Michael, I've just been reviewing our contract deliverables over the, you know, since I started keeping these records about 3-4 years ago. And what I have found is that in all these contract developments, remember, doing custom contract software development is a complex thing.
Right.
There's an industry statistic that says 18% of all software projects are abandoned before they go into production. And 55% are either late, sometimes very late, mm-hmm. missing key functionality mm-hmm. or shipped with operational defects that materially affect performance. Wow. When you take that 18% that never ship
right.
and the 55% that limp across the finish line, you know, missing mm-hmm. an arm, a leg, yep. or a head, that's a pretty miserable average statistic. But here was ours. We shipped 98.5% of all deliverables on time or ahead of time mm-hmm. and on budget or under budget.
Amazing.
When you read the risk report that shows the days of risk of Red Hat Enterprise Linux mm-hmm. and you look at how well we function in this increasingly challenging security context mm-hmm. and you look at how good we are at patching holes before they're publicly disclosed
right.
or patching holes, you know, in very, very short amount of time if it's a zero-day exploit, mm-hmm. it's mm-hmm. also, it's a stellar metric. When you look at how well defended the Linux kernel is against mischief because of mm-hmm. comprehensive work we've done at the runtime level, at the kernel level, mm-hmm. You know, at the system level, etc. That again is super high quality. But going back to Cygnus, by creating basically a perfect reputation,
right.
all these theoretical skeptical arguments mm-hmm. simply go by the wayside, mm-hmm. and you know, people would say, well, you know, Cygnus, once we started the company and we started delivering, they said, well, that's all well and good, but, you know, wait till Michael Thiemann can no longer program, mm-hmm. you know, because he's mm-hmm. spending too much time selling and managing,
right.
and your whole thing is going to fall apart because there are no more Michael Thiemanns. Mm-hmm. Bullshit. Yeah. There yeah. are so many great young talents mm-hmm. ready to do amazing things when they can find the right environment, mm-hmm. when they can find the right mentors,
yep.
you know, and when they've got enough field in front of them mm-hmm. that they can turn on the afterburners
yep.
and see what they can really do. And we recruited a lot of those people at Cygnus. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are still here at Red Hat.
Yeah.
You know, we have a number of people whose years of service exceed, you know, the time that Red Hat has been in business because they got credit for their days at Cygnus.
Amazing.
So what I would say is that a lot of the skepticism is a response to the abstract. It's a response to the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And when you okay. bring a concrete success story with just absolutely stellar credentials that doesn't just outperform the field,
mm-hmm.
but embarrasses
yeah,
the field,
yeah, yeah.
Then the skeptics begin to look like they're on the wrong side.
So this is a great segue to what I wanted to ask about next, and that is the notion of competition in an open source market, right? So you've written before about the nature of competition in open source and free software is different from the nature of competition perhaps in other markets because it's not a zero-sum game. You've described it, and I really like this image, as a sort of Mobius strip, right?
Uh-huh.
Where value is always flowing between different parties, and it's never a zero-sum game. So I'm wondering if you could elaborate on that or just rearticulate that, because I think that's a really interesting point. I think our listeners especially would find that interesting.
Yeah. So, and let me preface this, and I don't want to sound arrogant by saying this, but I believe it to be true. You know, it is easy to talk about the positive sum gain
yeah.
when so much is going in your direction.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
You know, so I will be the first to say that I have enjoyed seeing the open source community develop from a very privileged position,
mm-hmm.
that Cygnus had years of consistent growth, that Red Hat has enjoyed years of consistent growth. Our ability to execute at both of those companies has been phenomenal. And I believe that a lot of the open source business value accrues to those who have been successful. So
right.
let me just get that out of the way. But let me also say that there are many who have tried to bring the zero-sum game concepts to the open source community. Mm-hmm. They want to wall off some piece of technology,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
at least from a positioning point of view.
Mm-hmm.
They want to force everybody into that particular
mm-hmm.
Worldview. And a lot of folks have found themselves really, really struggling by trying to be the Microsoft of X. Where, which of course doesn't really have a valid place in an open source world. But that being said, I read a book in 2005, which I recommend to everybody. It's called The Only Sustainable Edge by John Hagel and John Seely Brown. And although it never mentions open source by name or even implies it, they tell story after story of companies who successfully transformed their business by shifting from the paradigm of the zero-sum game to the paradigm of the positive-sum game. And to me, the most compelling story in that book is the story of Li and Feng, which was in the 1970s, a textile manufacturer in Hong Kong, like 10,000 other textile manufacturers. And they made the paradigmatic leap from looking at competition as a zero-sum game to looking at all of their competitors as potential complementary assets. And more importantly, and this was the key insight for their company, they saw themselves as a potential complementary asset to their competitors. And one by one, as they would lose a deal here or a deal there, they would ask themselves the question, if we had been working with the competitor who won this deal instead of against them, how could we have done better? And step by step, they began building new systems, new relationships. And in the book, they talk about how 5,000 employees of Li and Feng now manage 7,500 relationships with other Asian textile manufacturers, and they do $5 billion a year in revenue, which, if you do the math, means that as a former textile company, this company does $1 million per employee in revenue, which by any measure is one of the highest revenue per employees I know of in the whole S&P 500. Yeah. It is miles ahead of probably at least 90% of that market. And they got there by recognizing this idea of how do we make ourselves a complementary asset. And in a lot of ways, the open source community is in a perfect position to ask and answer that question. How can we help company X build a better airplane? Or how can we help company Y build a better factory? Or how can we help company Z create a better website? Or, you know, you name it.
So you talked a little bit about, in your response there, you said about sort of creating a position of value, creating a sort of... you said value accrues to those who are in successful positions. So becoming successful looks different in an open source market, right? Becoming successful becomes more about what you enable as opposed to what you can withhold, right? And it becomes more about how you can maintain a standard, right?
That's right.
As opposed to how you can monopolize something. Is that a good summary?
That's a great summary. And another book that I recommend to everybody is a book called Switch by Chip and Dan Heath. What I did not realize when I started Cygnus was that you can't simply be different and expect to be successful. If you are different enough than the status quo, you must change the status quo to be successful.
I see.
And Switch is all about managing that change, especially when that change is hard. And to your point about success, again, when I started Cygnus, the general measure of success, which was typified by Bill Gates, was your wealth is a proxy for your intelligence. Your wealth is a proxy for your success. And whenever Bill Gates, I went to some CEO conferences back when he was CEO of Microsoft, and he would spout all kinds of theories about all kinds of stuff I thought was pretty much nonsense. And from time to time, the press would call him on it and say, well, we think that's not true. And Bill Gates would gleefully say, all right, short the stock. You know, daring them. And because Microsoft stock at that time was always on an upward trend, everybody sort of treated that as the final death of argument. And going back to how open source changes things, it's not just whether we deliver on time and on budget. It's not just whether or not this particular thing works or not, but changing how the customers think about and use software to reach things that they previously may not have even imagined.
Right.
And to give credit for this dynamic, flexible, evolutionary software platform for being that ticket to the next level. And so getting people to understand the transformational capacity of open source was very much part of maintaining success with these customers.
Let's see. So 10 years after Cygnus incorporates in 1989, it's 1999, and Cygnus merges with Red Hat.
Yep.
Do you remember when those discussions began and how, speaking of value and success, how both parties in that deal discussed the mutual benefit or value that each could add to the other and what that merger meant for both companies?
Yeah. So you've probably heard the expression, no plan survives first contact with the enemy. And the same may also be, you know, said of business bedfellows as well. I think that our conversations about the theories of mutual benefit ahead of time were paled in comparison to the actual benefits that we derived. But the facts are these. Cygnus was the first company that venture capitalists invested in. And we sort of taught the venture capital community the play. And I believe that Red Hat may have been the second such company to receive a major investment from Greylock, but we were the first. And as a result of that investment, the venture capitalists got substantial stakes in both companies, and they began to sort of look for what their exits would be, because venture capitalists put money in order to get 10 to 40 times that amount of money out. That's their general goal. And with respect to Cygnus, the challenge that we had was that as successful as we were in the tools space, the total market opportunity of tools is just not as big as the total market opportunity of operating systems, because operating systems really lead to platforms, and that's the big play. And Cygnus missed its opportunity to get into the platform space back in 1995. Somebody had told me about this little company in North Carolina called Red Hat, which had just grown from 5 to 15 employees and was doing Linux far better than any of the other myriad companies also commercializing and selling Linux distributions. And I was impressed enough to try to convince my co-founders that we should take 10% of our equity and buy Red Hat, but they thought that was a waste of time. And then 5 years later, Red Hat took 10% of their equity and bought us. So there was that. But the opportunities that became clear sort of immediately after the deal was consummated was that the Cygnus sales team and the Cygnus engineers were very, very comfortable building multi-year, multi-million-dollar relationships with customers. You know, our normal entry price was about $600,000 to do a tool chain. And then we also had some larger customers who would do $6 million deals. Red Hat, at that time, was selling hats and T-shirts and Linux distributions at Best Buy for $79.
Right, right.
And so Red Hat knew how to be super popular. Red Hat had more of a national brand than we did. But other than relationships with IBM and Dell and a couple of other companies, Red Hat really did not know how to build a customer relationship at the enterprise level. And so we had this great cross-pollination exercise. I remember overseeing one of these first sales integration meetings where all the Cygnus sales guys were just so eager to sell something so hot as Linux, and all the Red Hat salespeople were so eager to learn how to sell multi-hundred-thousand-dollar enterprise support agreements. And not long after that merger, we began the path of creating the world's first enterprise Linux. And enterprise Linux is obviously, it's a term you could apply to anything. I mean, marketing guys will stick lipstick on a pig if they think it makes it, if they think that's what makes it prettier. But the reality is, and I think history shows, Red Hat did do a very legitimate job of building a platform that had the right impedance match to the enterprise market. We had the applications support, we had certifications, we had a great training program that went along with it, and we really quickly grabbed the enterprise Linux market and then grew that market pretty much as fast as it could be grown, given how slow-moving a lot of enterprise evolution actually is.
Right. So the merger happens, you become, what is it?
CTO.
Yep. Red Hat, okay. And in a few years, there's a lot of change. Mm-hmm. As new, you know, the company makes new strategic directions, you move into enterprise, you know, Red Hat Enterprise Linux becomes real, and so does Fedora. There's a lot of new strategic directions happening. What's your day-to-day like around that time? What are you working most heavily on at that point?
Well, around that time, what we were really doing is we were building reference customers that were going to help us win the industry. So I was meeting with CIOs of Morgan Stanley and Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch, and we were listening to understand what enterprise really meant to them. Mm-hmm. We were explaining what we really felt we could do, and we were negotiating those partnerships with a whole bunch of vendors who at that time would have been delighted to see us actually go away.
Yeah.
But we had an amazing value proposition, which was to deliver the full power and efficiency of an Intel processor that by that time had completely lapped the Spark RISC processor. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the reasons that customers were so willing to move to Linux is that the Sun platform had simply run out of gas.
Okay.
These mainframe style machines had performance caps that were too low for the next generations that these banks wanted to build. And a horizontal scale out strategy trumped the scale up strategy that Sun had adopted. The cost profile was dramatically lower, but even the susceptibility to improvements, the ability to incrementally and rapidly change technologies was very, very appealing to an industry that was really chafing at the bit to roll forward. And they had been happy with Sun, but they had become very dissatisfied, and we were there to pick up that slack, and nobody else. You know, as much as they didn't like what Sun was doing, nobody else in the whole market was doing anything better.
Yeah.
I mean, it was kind of a real confederacy of dunces at the time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And along comes Enterprise Linux, some really, really brilliant engineering from Red Hat, from some other people working on the kernel, and we were able to demonstrate performance capabilities that just lit up the sky.
You used the term innovation a couple times, and that term can get pretty buzzy, get pretty vapid really quickly. But you've also written extensively about the way that innovation, the character of innovation in open source markets and under open source models, and sort of the motor of innovation when things are done the open source way. Can you elaborate a little bit on the nature of innovation in open source business?
Well, so I think it was Plato who said that necessity is the mother of innovation. And I think that one of the things that had really come to bedevil the proprietary software industry is that people had simply claimed far larger territories than they were willing to cultivate, let alone, you know, they were willing to defend the territories, but they were not willing to cultivate those territories. Mm-hmm. And so to give you some examples, there was a time when people were looking for building far more scalable systems than could be built out of proprietary RISC architectures. And there were lots of different theories about how this could be done. Mm-hmm. The great thing about open source is we could put all those different theories into competition, and those competitions could allow any kind of team configuration to be built. So it might be that somebody who was developing an application at Goldman Sachs would hop on and join a given kernel team that would that was going and pursuing a particular kind of multiprocessor, multi-threaded, or you know, multi-programming system. A different person has a different theory. They join a different team. And one of the things that has been great about the way that Linus Torvalds has managed all of this is that he truly has upheld this idea that the best ideas win. He really has he has often been difficult to work with. He often, you know, reminds the world he's just an asshole. But when a really really good solution shows up, he'll merge it in. He'll bump that version number, and we're off to the races. And what I would say is that at that time, when a company would basically say, well, you know, we own enterprise storage, but we're not going to do this thing you want for 5 years because, you know, it's not really correct. It's all well and good for a company to say, we're not going to do it, but it's no good at all to say, and you can't.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's really what open source is all about. We, you know, numerous times during that period and since, we've even heard from Linus himself saying, we're never going to do that. That's stupid. Yeah. That's ridiculous. Get it out of here. And then a couple of years later, after there's some more time with the idea and whatnot, all of a sudden, wow, that's it's in the mainstream.
It works.
Yeah.
You're obviously able to glimpse these insights very early, and it sets you up for success very early. And you are able to become a sort of open source visionary and open source evangelist very rapidly, and for a number of years. You've written and spoken about the power of open source thinking, open source methodologies, the open source way. I'm wondering if there's ever a time that open source has disappointed you.
Well, for sure, yes. I try and think of some good illustrative examples. I think that often, when I was president of the Open Source Initiative, we spent an extraordinary and I think sometimes excessive amount of time obsessing about licensing in ways that were not necessarily all that productive. One of the early ideas that came out of the Open Source Initiative before I joined was this idea that, you know, we need to have a lot of different licenses to be able to choose which one is best. So there's this idea that having a lot of different licenses would let us choose the best one. And that is a fine theoretical argument. But the Mozilla public license generated dozens of mutually incompatible licenses that really took a long time to untangle. So it... There became sort of two conversations that were constantly going on simultaneously. The first was, what is open source? And many clever lawyers or clever programmers who were lawyer wannabes were trying to figure out, how do I get just up to the edge of what open source allows, on the theory that the closer you got to the edge, the better the solution would be, because open source somehow is weak at the center. You know, which is a bizarre, bizarre idea. But anyway, so the what is open source? And then the second thing is, how can I make my open source thing different than everybody else so I can prove that I'm the smartest one? And this would lead to a lot of infighting or lack of cooperation that I think was very... that was ultimately detrimental. What I have seen lately, I saw a post just this past week saying that we live in a post-open source world.
Yeah, I've seen that.
And the premise of the post, is that with GitHub becoming a super major repository for new open source development, some substantial percentage of code is being checked in with no license whatsoever. And so one way to read that is, hey, it could be licensed under any license.
Right.
Another way to read it is, hey, it's public domain. Another way to read it is, hey, all this code is a potential future liability.
That's right. Yep.
And it's a and it's a big mess. And one of the ideas of the open source initiative was to make open source a safe choice, to make it be something that was well enough defined that you knew what it was, you knew what you could do with it,
mm-hmm.
and you knew who you could trust.
Yeah.
And to have so much code being developed with no license,
mm-hmm.
with no developer origin of certification or anything like that, it plays into many of the fears mm-hmm. that existed back when I was starting. Mm-hmm. And we addressed those fears by being upfront, by being not only transparent,
mm-hmm.
but also really standing for something very specific.
Yeah.
And the transparency at GitHub is great,
yeah.
but the nebulousness
mm-hmm.
of no license
is a
big problem. So those are some things that are on my mind.
Yeah.
I would say that it also has been somewhat frustrating that from time to time, major players decide that they want to stop and turn the game into a zero-sum game.
Mm-hmm.
And it is frustrating because it slows progress down for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
The way that some vendors have decided to try to compete on price, number one, which is a good way of keeping everybody honest,
mm-hmm.
but then to also put into their competitive terms and oh, by the way, if you use the other guy's stuff, then
you know,
we're not going to sell all the rest of the stuff you depend on. So people are using, I think, very traditional anti-competitive tactics against open source, which is again very unhelpful.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's not a whole lot of leverage that one happens if you take a step back and just mm-hmm. look at some big time geopolitical problems that mm-hmm. exist right now. While it may be super courageous for a party in one of those big fights to simply turn the other cheek,
mm-hmm.
and to bring peace by simply not fighting back,
mm-hmm.
you wonder just how many people can you stand to watch getting killed
mm-hmm.
before you realize or before you decide that may not be a good strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And in the world of open source, on a much more concrete layer and not involving human life, but just the success of a given
mm-hmm.
business, when open source does not have the kind of market power that many of these proprietary guys
mm-hmm.
have,
mm-hmm.
and that should be a great advantage, but it can be turned around to being a disadvantage. And the only the question that always resonates in my mind is the question that Abraham Lincoln asked about can our better angels
mm-hmm.
really
mm-hmm.
arise? And
mm-hmm.
and so far, what encourages me is that there is a lot of positive energy from both the younger people getting into open source, as well as the older people
mm-hmm.
who have
mm-hmm.
seen the generational ebb and flow of proprietary mm-hmm. versus open systems.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there still are a lot of people who are not as interested in seeing what can be destroyed as they are in seeing what can be built.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm really glad you brought up Abraham Lincoln in that last response, because it allows me to ask my final question, which is a rather selfish question because it's something I've always been curious about. In your writing, and now that I've had this conversation with you also in your speech, you pepper your prose with maxims, with
mm-hmm.
quotations
mm-hmm.
from historical figures, authors, popular figures. And that's always struck me as an interesting sort of idiosyncrasy in your writing, in your explanation, your mode
right.
of explanation and explication. And I'm wondering if that stems at all from your penchant for open source, right? The notion that there's eloquence in the simplistic, there's beauty in the shortest solution to the realization of insight, or if it's more about your tendency to do that is more about building on the ideas and the work of others?
That's a great question. Any eloquence is entirely accidental.
Okay.
The E word that I would look for is evidence. Uh-huh. So because of my background in science, I think that being able to look at analogous situations and to sort of, you know, validly argue similarities, similar cause and effect mechanisms, similar properties of state or motion, that those help to discern whether the effect being presently observed is something that can be observed as a more of a rule of nature or some special case. Mm-hmm. Earlier in this conversation, I talked about how people after the initial success of Cygnus, the next premise of demise was, well, as soon as Michael Tiemann stops programming, then the whole thing's going to fall apart. And of course that didn't happen. We know from history that it didn't happen. But at that moment in time, how do we know that this whole enterprise is not really built on underpricing the product of one hacker versus being able to build a sustainable model? And so from my perspective, it is important to not only be able to show here is something that's happening right now and is real, but to also reference reference the best analogies that we can find, not just best in terms of supporting the argument, but best in terms of really showing that the argument is really meaningful, is really general, and applies beyond the question of, are you really going to provide 7x24 support?
Right.
You know,
right.
Are you really going to honor your SLA when you do all this stuff? And at the end of the day, it is a question that I'm sure keeps our support team up at night. Mm-hmm. How do we meet the SLA?
Right.
How
right.
do we make sure that the customers are happy and want to renew? But a lot of, you know, to my mind, what really makes that happen is the ability of the team, the department, the business unit, the company to all be working on some larger page, which, by the way, includes the tens or hundreds of thousands or perhaps millions of other contributors who are all part of that ecosystem making stuff work so that our credit is good no matter where we go, whether we're, you know, working deep in some defense installation or whether we're working, you know, in some research lab cracking, you know, bosons and mesons and other things like that, or whether we are, you know, simply setting up an intranet for some major college campus. The ability to make work what we have been able to make work, which continuously requires the participation of a larger community. That's what it's all about. And I reference these other moments of history or these other bits of sage advice because people understand how those quotations applied to other great movements and how they applied to the more significant parts of our humanity than those that decide on vendor X or vendor Y, product X or product Y.
It reminds me of another thing I think you once wrote, is that you differentiate your thinking on open source and free software from folks who think about it differently. I'll just use one example. It might be arbitrary, but I think you've invoked it before. You've said some folks who champion free software, like Richard Stallman, for example, will make the case for open source and free software on philosophical or ideological grounds. But it strikes me that you almost see open source as almost a force of nature or some kind of universal tendency that is bigger than, I don't want to say mere ideology, but it's not just a worldview.
I am very, very happy that those two can coexist. You know, I think it's a terrible dilemma.
Right.
When one's where one's ethical worldview is in direct conflict with actual survival.
Yes.
I mean, it's great to see a movie about what kind of choices somebody's going to make.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
Between saving their girlfriend or rebooting the computer. Mm-hmm. But honestly speaking, I do believe that these two can operate in concert.
Right.
And I support and honor those who lift up the ethical behavior of free software.
Right.
But I also respect and support those who are making pragmatic progress, making mm-hmm. practical progress mm-hmm. by applying these to the day-to-day business.
Mm-hmm. Michael Thiemann, thank you so much for speaking with us today. It's been a real honor and a real pleasure.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.